Welcome underground. In our most bear-baity episode yet, I defend the aquatic ape hypothesis, the idea that humans evolved on the beach, against vigorous pushback from my establishment shill co-host. He argues that evolution is too unspeakably complex a subject to be reduced to simplistic narratives. He's wrong. Enjoy.
I think that you initially introduced me to this. Do you have a memory of that?
Probably. It's one that I like to share. I have a passion for theories that are clearly ridiculous, but also quite hard to dismiss. They kind of wear on you, you know.
Yeah.
So maybe everything we've learned is bullshit.
Yeah, it's like the phantom time hypothesis.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe history is actually far more cool than you think.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe there was.
You can't disprove it.
Maybe there was the Dark Ages. For those of you who haven't heard of the Phantom Time Hypothesis, it's the idea that the Dark Ages are dark because they didn't actually happen.
Yeah.
And we're now living in the 1700s or something.
It's far more plausible that...
Yeah, I mean, the timeline is just a human construct. We think of it as this kind of fact that exists out there.
Yeah.
It had to be constructed in the 1700s.
Yeah.
You know,
some made it up.
It could be very wrong. We just don't know. Mm. Anyway, well, it looks like with this podcast has immediately segued into a completely different topic. what we're supposed to be talking about is the aquatic ape hypothesis. And I'm going to start by introducing this with a quotation from Adam Rutherford, who is the inside science chap at Radio 4, who called it, well, actually he was talking about a book, The Naked Ape, but he called it erotic fantasy science. And if that doesn't get you interested in the topic, then I don't know what will.
I'm interested, but didn't David Attenborough also do like a series on it on Radio 4?
He did, I think in 2016.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he got a hell of a lot of stick for it.
Yeah.
So he's a sort of spiritual friend.
Yeah, he's a friend of the show.
Of the podcast. Yeah.
Or at least he was before he got kind of into eco stuff.
Yeah.
Back when he was dangerous.
Yeah, back when he was cool. Yeah, so the aquatic ape hypothesis, do you want to lay it out? Or just your understanding of it, actually, because, I mean, neither of us are absolute experts on the ins and outs of the exact...
We might have...
the exact sort of history of the genesis and all the various different expressions of this very wide-ranging theory are not our area of expertise. But what we want to do is we want to talk about our understanding of it, and then we can bat around some ideas of what we think about it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't really deal in history of ideas. What's that?
Lame.
Yeah.
See the ideas themselves. Let them live. Let them breathe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the central problem that I came across is why do we like beaches? Like, you go to a beach and it just feels right. And just everyone loves the beach. And so I was on a beach the other day, actually, and it was just amazing just looking around. This is in Morocco, so you've got a whole lot of, like, men in the desert on this beach having a great time. They'd sit there, or they'd, you know, dig a hole, or, wander around, dip their toes in the water. You know, people would just sit there in the sea, you know, bobbing around with their heads above the water.
Yes, yeah, so it's just being at the beach is an activity, isn't it?
Yeah, performing in a way that,
in a way that being in a field isn't.
It is not, yeah. And so why is it? And everyone's extremely happy. Like, it has this, it just feels right to us, to everyone. I think it's universal.
Yeah, I think it's more or less universal. I think you have to be a bit of an outlier to not like the beach. You have to be one of those people that's like a bit like me, actually. It doesn't really like the sun. Gets bored easily. But then, you know, as soon as I get a wetsuit on, I'm having a great time. But if I can't participate in the sort of aquatic bit, then I feel a bit bored at the beach.
Yeah. But at the same time, if you're going to just sort of lie anywhere, I'd choose a beach over...
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. So this is the problem then. This is the starting point. Why does everyone love the beach?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of no better theory to fit the facts than the fact we evolved there. And that is.
So So it's the idea. In a nutshell, this is the idea that, well, we love the beach because we are a particular species of ape, and that species evolved in a waterside environment. That's the idea, isn't it?
Yeah, on the coast. So I mean, the theory would go that there's a lot of competition between apes in the forest, and so some of the apes have ended up on the beach. And found that actually it's a, you know, it's actually pretty great. There's just loads of food just lying around. Like shellfish doesn't even run away. You got fish, so you got all this protein. And so, yeah, these apes have carved out a niche for themselves. And they change as a result to adapt to that environment. For example, if you're spending your time in the water, you don't need hair. But you do need to keep warm, so you get a layer of subcutaneous body fat.
Yep.
You need to be able to swim, so you get large kind of scoop-like hands. And fingers and toes are a little bit webbed.
Bipedalism as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Wading is the idea, isn't it? That bipedalism sort of developed through wading through the sort of shallows and looking for tasty.
Yeah, exactly, to support the weight as the ape is learning how to be on its feet. There's a whole load of other little adaptations.
The size of the sinuses. We've got big sinuses. The idea is that it makes the head more buoyant. I've seen that one.
Okay. It's a diving reflex that all babies have, and even adults have to a certain extent.
There's the ability to hold your breath, which I hear is quite rare.
Not only is it quite rare, but being able to actually control your breath, but also that is what unlocks speaking, because you need to be able to control your breath to speak.
Yeah.
And so that's the other thing, that the adaptations that we made and the change that happened as a result of being on the beach were the foundation of what made us human. So speech was enabled by breath control, which was necessitated by hunting for fish in the water or diving
kind of
for shellfish.
Slippery water monkeys, that's the idea. Does it have to be a beach, or can it be any sort of liminal aquatic environment? Can it be like lagoons? Can it be lakesides? Are you willing to include that idea in the theory, or does it have to be a beach?
I mean, to my mind, a lagoon is a beach.
Okay. What about sort of a lake swamp? Like mangrove swamps.
Yeah. They're grey areas. I think those are all valid. Other changes. So actually, all this protein made our brains bigger.
Ah,
so we got more detergent.
Omega-3.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And in fact, our brains rely on iodine that you can only really get if you're eating seafood. So people who live in landlocked countries have to have iodized salt and things like that, because if you don't have enough iodine, you get retarded. Not only do we get all these adaptations, but we're actually reliant on seafood.
Mm.
Like we literally cannot survive as intelligent humans without iodine.
Okay, that's the theory then, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's more. Where are all the early settlements for humans? They're all on the coast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that true? All of the early settlements for humans are on the coast?
Yeah, I think enough of them. We obviously don't know where they all are, but
it's quite a big claim. All of them. all right. And when do you... I mean, maybe you don't. Maybe you're not willing to commit this far, but when do you place this period of evolution? When did it happen? When in the sort of what's the time window in our evolutionary history?
Yeah, I mean, the time window given was like 3 to 7 million years ago, I think.
Yeah.
Because by 2 million, you got Homo erectus. I think, unhelpfully, there was a bit of a gap in the fossil record for that period in the 80s that is now slightly more full.
Yeah,
but,
it was actually in the 60s. There's this guy, Alistair Hardy, is a British... Sir Alistair Hardy, actually, is a British biologist who basically in 1960 kind of proposed the idea that those features that you have just described, many of them might be explained by a sort of aquatic or waterside period in our evolution. And yes, I think you're right about the time period, roughly 7 million to 3 million years ago. I think it was 7 to 5 million, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
And yes, at the time there was a fossil record. But Alistair Hardy was very clear that he said, we will be led by the evidence. This is just a hypothesis, and the evidence will either prove it or disprove it. But then what's really interesting about the aquatic ape hypothesis from the, I think anyway, having done a little bit of looking into it, is the sort of how it relates to the social history of the 20th century. Because happens is... Yeah, I know. Didn't see that coming, did you? What happens is that it's taken up by basically a feminist who who's called Elaine Morgan. She wrote The Descent of Woman in 1972, kind of picking up on these ideas. And this was a kind of feminist response to this idea of human evolution, that it's all about male hunters on the savannah, kind of being male with their big sticks and running around and spearing prey and all of this kind of thing.
Yeah, strength, speed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thrusting. And it's a kind of a feminist. She took this on as this theory as a really nice way of making an alternative feminist picture of peaceful waterside gathering of food by basically females.
It is a different vibe, isn't it? You think of apes on the beach, and it is different to apes on the savannah.
Yeah. Very much so. So, and you know, this launched she wrote a whole load of books, basically pushing the theory. But it's actually it's all to do with, it really is part of the feminist movement in the 70s and 80s, which I think is very interesting. And it is no comment on feminism per se to then note that the aquatic ape hypothesis itself is widely dismissed and indeed abused by the scientific consensus, and has been for some time. it's basically, I think that scientists who think of themselves as, you know, in the know, they call it an umbrella hypothesis. And what that means is it's a hypothesis that seems to explain all the facts.
Can you imagine?
But by trying to explain everything, it explains nothing. And then there is also the difficulty that the fossil record, as it has become filled in, doesn't seem to leave a gap for this utopian beachside kind of period. And there are alternative explanations for all of the features of humans that we've talked about. So, I mean, we could talk about thermodynamic regulation for hairlessness, and, you know, it's actually, the explanation is that the development of speech leads to breath control rather than vice versa, and so forth and so on. And, you know,
you've got 100 different major leaps rather than just one that makes logical sense. Yeah.
Yes. But this immediately unearths a very... it's a very, very interesting route into doing a little bit more of a critical deep dive into what evolution actually is. Because I think that evolution, and this is the other interesting thing I think about the aquatic ape hypothesis, is that it makes you think about what evolution actually is. Because we all think we understand evolution, but almost nobody does. And I think that even the best evolutionary biologists would say that actually, they don't really understand everything. We don't get everything about evolution. It's a weird thing.
I mean, it seems straightforward to me.
Well, perhaps you could give us your understanding of it then, if it's straightforward.
Well, so you have some children.
Yeah.
And they're all a bit random. You know, they all have different mutations or different combinations of genes, and so they all have different strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, some of these will work better from the environment you're in, and some won't. And the ones that work better are more likely to attract a mate and reproduce and successfully rear their children than the ones who don't. And so although those changes are small, like over 100 generations, you get some quite major changes. Am I missing something? Or...
Well, I mean, that's a very kind of broad brushstroke idea. The idea that there will be genetic variability within a population, and that environmental pressures will lead to some genetic variants being more fit, in quotation marks, than others for the environment. And so they go on to reproduce more and so on and so forth. But then, as soon as you start drilling down, it becomes immensely more complicated. So, like, what is the unit of evolution? For example, this is a classic Hoyle question. You know, is it the organism? Is it the gene? Is it the allele? Is it the information that's encoded within the allele? Is it, you know, what's the actual unit?
Why isn't it the organism? I mean, you know, that's the butterfly or the...
Well, because, the thing that you can argue that the thing that's being selected for or not is the genes. The organism is irrelevant in a sense because the organism is just a sort of a phenotypic efflorescence of proteins that are coded for within DNA. What's actually surviving is the genetic sequence.
Yeah, but like, I'm quite confident I'm the important bit, or more important than my genes.
Well, you may be confident okay. that you're more important than your genes. And I'm glad you have such self-esteem.
Well, what's the purpose of this discussion? Like why does it matter?
Why does it matter? Because it matters because when you look into the aquatic ape hypothesis, it's not like water hasn't played clearly a big role in the evolution of Homo sapiens, right?
Yeah.
But the picture that we have in our head of a kind of nice straight line progression from simple to complex, from lower to higher, from monkey to human, is seductive. And it's very seductive to think that somewhere along that journey, we had this kind of interlude on the beach, and that's what gave us a kind of a kick up the ladder to what we are now. And I know that you're more sophisticated than that in terms of what you're thinking, but that it kind of does lurk.
No, that is kind of what I'm thinking. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that it is way, way, way too simplistic terms of visualizing what is actually going on in evolution. Because in evolution, there is no one straight line. Like a species itself does not change or evolve, right? What happens is that one individual within a species has one offspring that is then the common ancestor of all of a new species. It's not like the whole species changes over time according to environmental pressure. There's just one organism that gets born, that then goes on to have, you know, further children, further children, further children, and that becomes a new species that's then running in parallel to the previous species. But this is happening all the time with loads and loads of different offspring.
Right? Yeah.
So you have this kind of, it's not this straight line of a single species turning into another species, you know, moving from simplicity to complexity. Instead, what you have is this kind of unbelievably complex deluge of change that is interacting with an unbelievably complex deluge of environmental factors, and there's sexual selection going on as well, by the way, which is another kind of complicating factor.
It's not pure fitness to the environment.
No, it's not pure fitness to the environment. And so...
Well, women are part of the environment, so I guess it is.
From our perspective. It's far too simplistic to think of just an interlude at the beach, right?
None of what you said implies that. You can just have the speciation happening on the beach rather than in the forest. I mean, you're in a different environment that selects certain things, and yeah, you have all the immense complexity that I'm not denying, but I mean...
But the idea that you have an entire species of monkey that moves down from the trees and decamps en masse to the beach and camps
there. Not saying that. A group of monkeys. Over a couple of million years, some of those monkeys
So they stayed at the same beach for a million years.
It seems unlikely, but...
It does seem unlikely.
Hung around beaches, I don't know.
It's way more complex than that.
What you're saying is that, you're expecting one entire species of monkey goes to one specific beach and stays over 3 million years and comes... That's clearly ridiculous,
but it is ridiculous. Yes, you're right, yeah. Because what's actually happening is that you have to think about, individuals.
Yeah.
In individual organisms is one way of thinking about it. making an unbelievably complex array of different choices, and they'll find themselves in an unbelievably complex array of different environments over time.
Yeah.
And the kind of the selection is happening all the time.
Yeah.
And so the notion of a single organism or a single species just spending time in one location and then changing according to the dictates of that location, it just isn't right. It's not the right. It's not how evolution works.
But I mean, no one's making that claim. It's that, yeah, some monkeys spent some time around beaches.
So, there's another. It's more. You have to think of it more in terms of over millions of years, individual organisms within our line of common descent are, by chance, finding themselves better able to cope in certain waterside environments. And so waterside environments are one selection pressure that is present over that period of time, which is a really, really long period of time. But it's one selection pressure that is in an absolute kaleidoscope of you know, an uncountable number of different selection pressures, which include, you know, everything from disease to sexual selection to other sort of hominid species. And it's also complicated by the fact that some of these species are actually interbreed at various different points along the line of descent as well. So, you know, we famously have Neanderthal DNA within us.
I feel it strongly.
And so, it's way more complicated than just this nice, simple straight line with an interlude at a sort of a waterside environment. And I think that, you know, what the problem that scientists have with the aquatic ape hypothesis is that it's way too simple for what actually evolution is in reality, which is an incredibly messy, complex, complicated, almost unfathomably random statistical process that we as human beings who like a narrative just can't really get our heads around.
And it seems, I think you're overcomplicating it. At a sort of level of abstraction, it seems to make perfect sense. Again, like, how do you think whales evolved? I mean, yeah, there's a lot of complicated stuff happening, but fundamentally some deer-like mammals started swimming a bit more, and then 50 million years later they're very different from the deer that were their closest relatives.
What you just said there was, how do you think that whales evolved, as if whale was something that evolution was heading towards. But that's not the right way to think of it. You know, whales...
Was how did some deer become enormous whales?
Yeah, so, I mean, that individual deer didn't become an enormous whale. You know, that's the truth of it. That deer, one of those deer, had an offspring that then had offspring that then had offspring. You know, that through chance and mutation, sexual selection, all kinds of things, over an unfathomably long period of time, through many twists and turns, not a straight line, ended up by chance with one of its descendants, you know, looking like a whale.
Sounds like evolution to me.
I know. I know what you say, but the point I'm trying to get to is that the aquatic ape hypothesis is a very neat, simple to understand story.
Yeah.
And that neat, simple to understand story is both its power and why it is sort of viewed as so pernicious by evolutionary scientists. Because evolution is not a neat and easy to understand story. It's unbelievably complex. And
but how is that a less satisfying story, though, than like some monkeys coming down from the trees and going to savannah and then starting to pick up spears?
I think modern evolutionary scientists would say that that's also a misleading, powerful story, but ultimately a misleading one, because it's more complicated.
And where does that leave us?
It leaves us with confusing complication.
That's just not useful, is it?
Well, it is useful because I think understanding evolution properly is this a very uncomfortable process for us human beings, and it's a process of kind of letting go of a narrative. And that's why the aquatic ape hypothesis is so interesting, is because it's the perfect counterfoil to the way that you should think about evolution. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I just still think that, yeah, it was very complicated, but fundamentally there's a central strand of narrative that, yeah, it wasn't predetermined. And yeah, you know, lots happened along the way. You know, over 3 million years, these apes, you know, went through a lot. And a lot died that might actually have been, you know, the best ape, but an accident happened.
You've accepted my points that the fossil record doesn't fit. You've accepted my points that this isn't about a whole species changing. You've accepted the point about that, you know, actually, you know, evolution doesn't work in quite that kind of smooth, kind of simple way. So which bit of the theory are you defending specifically?
I'm defending all of it. I mean, the fossil record, yeah, I think is as open to interpretation as anything else. I think the fact that we are as we are with these specific adaptations is stronger evidence than some 5 million-year-old maybe bones.
Do you want to go through some of the sort of the what would you call it? The I can't think of the word. There's a phrase for this. The sort of demystifications of the various features of human biology, hairlessness.
Yeah, I mean.
Hairlessness, for instance, is only a feature of fully aquatic mammals such as whales and dolphins. Semi-aquatic mammals such as otters and water voles are extremely furry. Sexual selection and adaptations to heat loss better explain our pattern of body hair. Well, I don't know how, but this is the Scientific American saying. So this is, you know,
they're right about COVID, weren't they? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was just saying, you know, they've had more time to think about this than COVID. In their defense.
I think they put less effort into it.
Sexual selection may also explain our body fat distribution. All right, it says may, but still, which differs between the sexes.
How? Like,
well, because you look at certain distributions of fat and you think, oh, it's better for child rearing.
I think that's more of a stretch than having a use.
Well, that's the thing about evolution. It can be both. Like, it can be both. It can be both.
And it is both with the aquatic ape.
It can be both a sort of a sexual selection pressure working at the same time as a waterside environment pressure, right? And that happening at the same time in a million different locations at a million different times, you know, within that million years. But the point is there's no single narrative of just spending time at the beach and changing and then moving on. It's instead a fractured...
I never moved on.
a fractured kaleidoscope of different environments and different changes and different pressures at different time, all happening at the same time.
Yeah, but I say a narrative where we say it's purely sexual selection is weaker than a narrative that says it's sexual selection and also the environment.
This isn't saying that it's purely sexual selection. What this is saying is that there is more than one selective pressure that is happening to explain the things that aquatic ape hypothesis wants to claim purely for its own.
I don't think it's claiming exclusivity. It's just claiming that's what happened.
I think aquatic ape hypothesis is implicitly claiming exclusivity because otherwise it's not interesting.
But it isn't like, you know, these things can work together. If sexual selection and living in the sea are pulling in the same direction, then you're gonna develop a lot faster. If the two are in conflict, then we wouldn't get very far at all.
Yeah, and you know, I'm definitely not saying that waterside environments have not been a significant selective pressure on our species. They clearly have, right? But the idea that there is a set period of time that we went through where we were waterside, which explains fully certain features like hairlessness, breath control, bipedalism, blah, 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 is not right. Because it doesn't make sense on loads of different levels. It doesn't make sense on the mechanics of evolution. It doesn't make sense because there are lots of other reasons why these things will have developed that you can point to, you know, quite convincingly. It doesn't fit with the fossil record. And it, when you really think about it, it just doesn't, evolution just doesn't work like that. Compared with other animals, we are not actually that good at swimming, and our skin leaks as well, letting water in so that our fingers become prune-like after a long bath.
Let's say in fresh water.
What about walking on two legs? That's something all apes do a bit of. While wading in water, certainly, but also reaching for fruit, performing aggressive displays, or simply moving around in trees. If we evolved from ancestors...
They're less good at it.
Yeah, if we evolved from ancestors who already stood up in trees, we don't need an extraordinary explanation for why we ended up standing on the ground.
But the extraordinary explanation kind of helps. It sort of feels like it's more likely to happen with the wading than without. If we're talking about probabilities and chaos... It's like every single one of these things is made more likely by being on the beach.
Yeah, I mean, these things that will have evolved, you know, these things that will be have been selected for by loads of different pressures will have turned out, will have also helped us, perhaps marginally, in these waterside environments. And so that's all to the good. But the notion that there is this kind of period of time where we are exclusively waterside and that explains these features is wrong.
Okay, but these features came about when we spend a lot of time on the beach. All these other things can happen whilst being on the beach, and so they happen quicker and more strongly and fit the facts.
What does that mean, though, happened quicker and more strongly? Like, can you actually break that down into the mechanics of evolution?
Okay, so what are we debunking? Okay, so bipedalism.
Right.
Okay, yeah, some apes can stand up to reach fruit.
Yeah.
That is something they've developed over, let's say, 10 million years.
Yeah.
But we are far better at it. Yeah, you know, we can run and...
Yeah. Which you can't do in water, by the way.
You can do pretty well. Well, yeah, okay, yeah. So our endurance running came later.
Yeah, because that's all about running down prey, isn't it? That's how we catch prey. We have better thermodynamic regulation, which means that we can run for longer. We can't run faster, but we can run for longer. And so, yes, a gazelle can outrun you in speed terms over a short different distance, but over sort of 5K, you will exhaust it. It will become overheated because it can't sweat as efficiently because it's covered in fur. And so it will eventually collapse through heat exhaustion, and then you just spear it and you're done.
Yeah, you know, so once we'd learnt to walk on 2 feet, and that had a whole load of other advantages that we applied to all sorts of other things. Like you know, speaking was an advantage, having a bigger brain was an advantage, and yeah, being able to run efficiently was an advantage that it wasn't planned for. Like, you couldn't possibly plan for that. As you say, it's just chaos, but suddenly we were bipedal, and then, oh no, there's other stuff we can do with this.
Yeah, so in other words, there are lots of different environmental pressures working all the time. There is not this kind of exclusive period of kind of beach holiday in which...
I think you're simplifying things a bit. I'm just saying that all these things are made more likely by being on a beach.
Uh-huh. I think that's the slight...
Which means that the idea that we spent... No. I mean, that just makes...
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that the notion that we spent a few million years evolving on the beach... is more likely because the traits we have are made more likely by having been on the beach. Like, just statistically, it is more likely than a savanna or pure savanna with no beach.
Okay. So why is it more likely that we evolved bipedalism in a waterside environment than it is that we evolved it on the savanna chasing down game?
Because nothing else evolved it on the savannah chasing down game. So like, to go from 4 feet to
nothing
2 feet...
Nothing else like, evolved it in a waterside environment.
Yeah, fair. But you can't just go from 4 feet to running on 2 feet. Like, there's this intermediate phase where you're a bit shifted by bipedalism and it has no utility. Like, you can't start...
Reaching for fruit and trees.
Yeah, there's still a bit of a leap from reaching for fruit and trees to running down gazelle. Yeah. And then that gap is best explained by practicing in the water.
Practicing.
And just getting, well, you know, over a million years.
Yeah.
Adapting for the water.
Yeah.
This is basic to me. Like, you can't go from reaching fruit to chasing gazelles. There needs to be some intermediate phase. And that intermediate phase is just getting better and better and better over 1,000 generations of wading through water, and the ones who wade through water better are the ones that have more children. Yeah,
but it can be both at the same time. You know, the same organisms that are learning to pursue game on 2 feet are also interacting with waterside.
You straight up can't. A gorilla straight up just cannot pursue a gazelle to death. That's not something they can do. This is my challenge with evolution in general, is that you often have these intermediate phases where, like, half a wing is shit. Like, it's less useful than having no wing, and it's less useful than having a wing. And you just got to, to develop something like a wing, you need to go through this phase of being far less fit for your environment because you've got this extra appendage that consumes resources and offers no value. And what I like about the beach is that it gives you that narrative of how we got from not being able to chase a gazelle to being able to chase a gazelle. There's no intermediate. Like, you either can or you cannot chase down a gazelle. If you can't, then there's no point even thinking about it.
So
it's not adaptive.
So in your theory, right?
Yeah.
There are some apes and they're at the beach, right?
Yeah.
And they're practicing wading.
And they're happy.
They're wading in the water. They're practicing wading in the water.
They are wading. Right, okay. It's adaptive. Right, they want to pick up
wading.
Shellfish.
They're wading.
Yeah.
And then what? One of them goes, all right, lads, I think I'm ready. I'm ready for the gazelle now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go for it. I'm going to leave the beach where we've been for a million years, apparently. And I'm going to go and chase down
the gazelle. Deliberately strong
and American. No, I'm not. I'm genuinely curious about the mechanic.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I can do this now.
Okay.
Well, what's your better... give me a better narrative.
Well, I don't have a better narrative. That's my entire
point.
Okay,
well, so it's have no explanation.
I'm just saying the explanation is much more terrifying and complicated than we like to think about.
Because
it involves incremental alteration over deep time in a chaotic and random way. And it is very disturbing to us to think that we are a result of a chaotic and random process that is too complex for us to understand. The idea that, or for one human being to wrap his head around or her head around fully, the idea that we are the result of a random, chaotic, unbelievably complex process, a process that's so complex that we as individuals cannot get our heads around it, is an unbelievably disturbing thought, because we like to package things into narratives in order to understand them. And there can be no more fundamental thing to understand than how we came to be. And so this very fundamental thing, the fact that it doesn't yield to a nice narrative, we hate it.
Well, but it does yield to a nice narrative.
Yes, but a false one.
Well, I mean, you're allowed several narratives at the same time. Okay. So it doesn't have to be just one story. Like, this is one of, a million things are going on at the same time, but this is an important one. And I think there is value in discussing it. Okay, what you're saying is, we can't know anything.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying we can't know anything.
Right. We can't know anything about evolution. Yeah.
No, what I am saying is that evolution is one of those things that appears to be relatively simple, but as soon as you start really digging into it and starting to think about it, it becomes incredibly, incredibly difficult to wrap your head around.
What about animal husbandry? Like we've been doing that for millennia. Like if you breed the small dog with the small dog, you'll probably get smaller dogs.
Yeah. I mean, evolution can happen ridiculously quickly. I mean, there was a study out recently that shows that the change in beak sizes in chaffinches on the Galapagos. I mean, Darwin assumed that it would take thousands of years at least for these things to happen, but actually it can happen within sort of a few decades in the right conditions. And also, what we do with dogs and cows and so forth shows that as well.
Yeah. So we're allowed to have those narratives?
Well, that is a narrative because with dogs and cows, there is a plan and there is an intention and an intelligence being applied. It's not chaotic and random.
Thousands of this is the whim of 100 generations of breeders that...
Yeah, but
it's pretty random.
That's nothing.
Fashions come and go.
But there is a narrative there. Because there is a plan and there is intention and there is, there are human intelligences at work on it. But the process of evolution, nobody has changed a dog into a jellyfish in 100 generations. And that's, that's the hard problem of evolution, is that how is it that your great-granddad to the power of 100 is a jellyfish? And that's true, by the way. if you just go back generation by generation, whatever it is, 100,000 times, you would be looking at a jellyfish. And it'd be more than 100,000, actually. But, you know, whatever the number is, big number. But nevertheless, it is a definite number. And that is true for you. It is literally true for you and literally true for me. That if you could somehow just jump back generation by generation, eventually you'd get to a jellyfish.
I think I could put a narrative on that.
But that is an unbelievably sort of complex and mysterious thing to understand. I'm not saying it isn't understandable, but you have to let go of a lot of our kind of human intellectual habits about storytelling in order to actually start to get towards the truth of that process.
But like ape to human is a bit easier to get your mind around than jellyfish to human.
It is. But the process, the underlying process we assume is the same as getting from jellyfish to human, as it is from getting from ape to human. And of course the thing that always blows my mind is that jellyfish are still around, right? And so are chimpanzees, who are, I think, our closest relatives. So it's not that you don't get... It's not that the whole species changes over time. Instead, what you have is species branching out into other species kind of chaotically all the time.
It's one of my favourite facts. Which is older, sharks or the rings of Saturn?
Presumably sharks.
Yeah, I wouldn't be asking.
But I mean, yeah, that is a cool fact.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. It's like, yep, that's optimized. We're not getting better than that.
So anyway, I mean, you know, it would have probably been a slightly more enlightening discussion if I had done my research into this bit closer to the actual.
Well, you just rejected the whole notion of knowledge and.
What I do think is that it is absolutely clear that waterside environments have been a major factor that has played a process in our evolution. Definitely. And the things that the features that have evolved that make us human, in a way, what human beings are, the niche of human beings is niche switching. I'm not the person who has had that insight, by the way. I actually can't remember who it is, but it's in a book I read. So and the author points out very insightfully, that says that the human niche is niche switching. So we don't have a niche. Our ecological niche is the ability to switch niches.
And what better place to learn that than in the liminal environment where sea meets the land?
No. Well, yes, what best place to learn that than in a series of different liminal environments? And the waterside environment being one of them, the boundary between forest and savanna being one of them. You know, the boundary between mountain and plain being one of them. You know, the features that have appeared that define us are ones that allow us to switch niches. They're, in a sense, they're not particularly specialized in any one direction massively strongly, other than that kind of reprogrammability of the human frontal cortex. And I try not to use computer metaphors for the brain, because I think thinking of the brain as a computer is to completely misunderstand.
That'd be a model would help understanding, yeah.
but you know, I think in this instance, it's probably the easiest thing to express it, the idea that we can reprogram ourselves very easily as human beings. That's the one really specialised feature, I think, that we have. And so... Hairlessness is something that, yeah, brilliant, works. It's kind of useful in water, but it's also really useful in thermoregulation when you're chasing down a gazelle. And it's also really...
No, if that was true, then everything would be bald, and it's not.
Yeah, but that's where sexual selection comes in. I'm not trying to say anything about baldness there in terms of sexual selection. I'm just saying that, you know...
Ah, but my body is covered in hair.
Yeah.
My brother met someone who was in my house at school.
Yeah.
And his one memory with me was, he had two recollections of me. I was good at swimming, and the only 13-year-old he ever knew to have back hair.
Well, there you go. You're good at swimming, and you have loads of body hair. Where is your theory now?
Well, I'm just one of those kind of random outliers that drives things forward. Yeah, okay. I'm the grit that forms the oyster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm terrible at swimming, and I don't have nearly as much body hair as you. I'm just like a sack of bones. Just throw me in the pool and I sink. Sort of clanking around, sort of pathetically.
Your ancestors spent too much time on the savannah.
Yeah, my ancestors were like chasing down gazelle, having a great time being jocks. And yours were being, you know...
eating oysters.
Nicely feminine at the beach.
Peaceful.
Yeah.
Gathering.
Gathering, yeah.
Communicating.
Communicating, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cooperating, yeah.
I mean, Daniel Dennett is on your side. Do you want a quotation from Daniel Dennett?
Yes, please. And a biography, so I know whether his endorsement is something I value.
I think Daniel Dennett's a pretty big deal.
Okay.
I can't actually as you can tell from that, I can't give you the biography, but I think he's pretty sound.
Is it Dennett or Dannett?
Dennett. He's a philosopher. He crops up in philosophy quite a lot, Daniel Dennett.
American. Good bit.
He
died this year.
Oh, gotcha. In his discussion of evolutionary philosophy, he commented, "During the last few years, when I found myself in the company of distinguished biologists, evolutionary theorists, paleoanthropologists, and other experts, I've often asked them to tell me, please, exactly why Elaine Morgan must be wrong about the aquatic theory. I haven't yet had a reply worth mentioning, aside from those who admit, with a twinkle in their eyes, that they have also wondered the same thing." So, I mean, this podcast is another one to add to the list of replies not worth mentioning, no doubt, to Daniel Dennett. So there you go, he's on your side. He thinks, why not? What do you think about that?
Yeah, sorry, I'm just reading his biography. Oh, here's one, The Four Horsemen of New Atheism.
Yeah.
Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and him.
Yeah.
They went out of fashion, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I think everyone just realised that they kind of believe things just as hardly, just as kind of intensely as your kind of most dyed-in-the-wool sort of, Alpha Course evangelist kind of thing. You know, they're just as committed to their faith. So, I mean, there's something about that kind of real zealous earnestness that's just never going to be cool for long, you know?
Yeah.
We will never fall into that trap.
So I knew you when you were 20.
What does that mean?
We'd never fall into it. Oh, sorry, I thought we were talking about new atheism.
Oh, right. That's fair enough. That's a fair cop.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I used to be a really real... I used to consider... I would self-identify as a radical atheist when I was younger. Yeah.
Well, what's the difference between an atheist and a radical atheist?
A radical atheist is not just that they don't believe in God, but they think that belief in God is an evil that needs to be eradicated.
Oh,
so it's a kind spicy. It's kind of like it's a proactive evangelical atheism.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I should respect that more than the kind of
I don't even know whether I'm an atheist anymore. I don't know. Maybe we could do a podcast on that. It's probably more interesting than my sort of slightly incoherent thoughts about evolution. I've thought about this a lot more. So.
Yeah. Fair enough, probably.
Yeah. Here's another quotation that you'll like.
Oh, go for it.
"An arcane and eldritch item of fashionable nonsense in the shuddering slush pile of human evolutionary rubbish is the aquatic ape theory."
According to who?
That's from a friend of the show, The Guardian.
Which is clearly strong evidence in favour of aquatic ape theory.
Yeah, actually, to be fair, I've heard it. Yeah. I'm slightly more. I'm feeling.
I'll take the word eldritch as well.
Warm towards it now.
It's got a bit of Lovecraft about it as well.
It does, yeah. The idea that we kind of go through this slightly slimy metamorphosis.
Yeah, it's a bit fishy.
Yeah. So it is bullshit. Right.
Have you seen that tribe of water nomads who are specially adapted for swimming, so they can hold their breath for like ages. They can see underwater clearly.
Yeah, there are pictures of them on sort of internet fact sheets about aquatic ape theory.
Are there?
Yeah. It's this incredibly niche tribe of like two dozen individuals. It's really firm evidence that the entire species is...
They proved the concept.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean,
probably happened quite quickly as well.
Yeah.
Proper narrative on it.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there anything else that we need to discuss about the aquatic ape hypothesis? I feel like I just kind of was very boring and just kind of chattel over it.
You're postmodern, which was cool in the '80s.
Yeah. But I think the most interesting thing about it is that actually what it is really about is feminism in the second half of the 20th century.
Well, I mean, the feminists will use the tools they have, but I mean, to me, what it's really about is the beach and why we like it. Like,
yeah.
You just feel so at peace on the beach.
Yeah.
In like quite a fundamental way.
Yeah.
It's like you go to the beach and you're coming home.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that does need explaining, doesn't it? I haven't really provided any explanation, alternative explanation for that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, a depth of our subconscious is a far scarier place than trying to put narratives on evolution and maybe anything.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that the sea is one of the very few natural spaces which is almost entirely blank. So it's quite a unique thing, isn't it? Because we're finely tuned, one assumes, to detecting threats in complex environments because, you know, we spent a lot of time in forests and we still do. And I kind of think of a city as a kind of modern version. I mean, it's complex and there's potential threats all over the place. And so actually going to an environment where your visual field has only really got three elements in it, sort of sand, sea and sky, is probably very relaxing to those various systems that are threat detectors. What do you think about that?
Edlon's afraid of the sea.
Listen, there's a thinking face going on.
Yeah, well, I was about to say, I mean, you know, the step or, you know, the souls we played or something, it has the same thing where it's much going on in the visual field. Then I was like, yeah, you feel pretty good on the Salisbury Plain.
Yeah, I was going to say, you kind of do get the same effect though, don't you, on the step and on Salisbury Plain, yeah.
And obviously this would be a gross oversimplification.
yes.
It would be. Yeah, there'd be thousands of reasons why we feel at peace on the beach, well, including the fact we evolved there.
I'm not saying that all relatively simple narrative explanation for things are wrong. I'm just saying that
just my ones. Yeah.
No, just ones that touch on evolution tend to be wrong because of the nature of evolution.
Yeah, nothing else is chaotic. Yeah.
Well, okay. Obviously, lots of things are chaotic. And look, I agree that ultimately we always need to boil things down into a narrative to understand it. I'm just saying that the true narrative for evolution is a scarier one because it's one in which there is no underlying structure that leads to us in any meaningful sense. The narrative...
Emergent.
The narrative is one of chaos and meaninglessness. But I don't think of that as a kind of metaphysical insight, because while that might be the story of evolution, I think the story of consciousness is very different. So consciousness can be a chaotic outcrop of evolution, fine. That doesn't stop it being meaningful on its own terms. It's perfectly, you know, reasonable to think that something that emerged through a chaotic process actually is structured and capable of imposing meaningful structure on chaos. I think that's perfectly consistent. I don't think that's inconsistent at all. So I'm not one of those people that's a nihilist. I think that consciousness is very important and meaningful, and that there is such a thing as truth and meaning and beauty and all of those things. But I just don't think that evolution is something that was that led to those things in a meaningful sense. They are accidental in the sense of there is no meaningful process that led to them. But that's one of the most astonishing things about them.
Yeah, I still don't see how that's incompatible with us evolving on the beach.
Because... Okay. All right, well, I have to agree to disagree about that.
Massive cop-out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't actually mean that cop out. You're just incorrect about that. But I'm not gonna, if you don't want me to cop out, then I'll say it boldly. That's fine.
I'll need to read some more forums and get back to you.
Yeah, you do your research. Come out.
Handling con objections to aquatic.
Okay, well, I'm not quite sure whether that one's fit for publication or not. But it could be a funny one to listen to.
Exactly.
Send it to the Scientific American.
Half of us agree with you.
Yeah. How well did I do at being a sort of a, what do you call it, like a mainstream blue pill chill?
Yeah, you did remarkably well. Yeah, suspiciously well. Okay? Yeah.
Big Pharma is paying me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The man.
Hillary Clinton is my puppet master.
Yeah. Big archaeology.
Just out of shot. Yeah, big archaeology. Yeah. Paleoanthropology or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was reading something the other day. Like, it is a bit weird how no one's allowed to do any archaeological digging without a government saying yes, they can, and then controlling the results. Like, that is a bit weird.
I think that's a dangerous rabbit hole to go down. I agree that there should be less regulation in general, but I don't think that that's evidence that the government is manipulating our... I mean, obviously the government does manipulate...
It is consistent.
Obviously, the government does manipulate our view of all kinds of things, but I don't think that...
We say the government, but I mean, where's all the interesting archaeology? Well, it's in places where the government absolutely is suppressing, where's all the cool stuff? Yeah, it's in Africa and the Middle East. Oh. How do you get that permit? Oh.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's in the same way that oil tends to be there as well. Because if it wasn't there, we'd have already used it.
No, it was everywhere. We just choose not to. I mean, the North Sea's full of it. We're just not allowed to.
I thought there wasn't that much left in the North Sea.
There's a shitload.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but how extractable? It's difficult to get to, isn't it? It's the stuff that's not very extractable.
That was the case in the 70s. It's now quite straightforward.
Okay.
But they're not issuing any new licenses.
Well, we could do a podcast about North Sea oil policy. That would get the juices going.
Yeah. And fracking, we can get that in there as well.
Maybe we could do one just constructing a really, really grand conspiracy theory about archaeology, the North Sea, and Keir Starmer. Giants. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Alrighty. Well, I guess that wraps that up. I'm a bit sad, actually, to be stopping talking about that. I enjoyed talking about that, even if it wasn't a particularly sophisticated conversation from my side.
The people want bear baiting.
Yeah. I hope so. Always will.
Oh, we'll find out. We're A-B testing.
Yeah.
This is our most bear baity podcast yet.
Yeah, that's true. I'm glad I'm on the side of the establishment for our most bear-baiting podcast. I mean, I respect contrarians deeply, but I'm kind of glad that...
Yeah, they're important.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well,
it's the man getting to you.
I'm going to tell it. Yeah, the man has got to me. And on that bombshell, goodbye, everyone.